right, our third speaker, Brian Harnetti, will be presenting archival ethnography and the Berea Appalachian Sound Archives. Just a little background on Brian. He's a composer and artist. His creative and scholarly work connects sonic archives, performance, ecology, and place. Many of his pieces transform archival material, including field recordings, transcriptions, and historic recordings, into newly recontextualized sound collages. For the past decade, this has led to a focus on projects with sound archives, including the Berea College Appalachian Sound Archives in Kentucky and the Sun Ra El Saturn Creative Audio Archive in Chicago. Harnetti received a PhD in interdisciplinary arts at Ohio University and degrees in music composition from the Royal Academy of Music, London, master's degree there, and the Ohio State University bachelor's degree there. His latest Atavistic Records release, The Star-Faced One from the Sun Ra El Saturn Archives, was Mojo Magazine's 2013 Underground Album of the Year. Two new albums based on the Berea Archives entitled Raw Head and Bloody Bones and The Night is Drawing Nigh will be released this fall on the Dust to Digital label in Atlanta. Thank you very much, Brian.
Good morning. Barbara Kunkel's 1973 field recordings of Lexie Baker, J.P. Fraley, and others begin not with a tune, but instead invite the listener in with conversation and laughter.
Deb brings more chairs in here. brings more chairs. I'm
going to
push you out.
That's
chairs.
The best beginning of the tape I ever had. You're going to love me in this university, let me tell you.
Play that.
You know, I hear that pretty music.
Is relative to that pork and deer living good. I mean, you know, Paul, Uncle Rich used to have Fass play that pork and deer. If you don't care, play that one again.
That's
a good fiddle tune. You remember he used to, that's his about his favorite, wasn't it?
Yeah, sure.
I used to go up there and stay all night, and he'd have Fass play.
Yeah, he'd lay down on the bed and tell Fass what to play.
Who
fine.
Was
this? Fass Baker. Kenny's dad. Actually,
After they finish playing, the process starts again with the conversation picking up right where it left off, and Fraley already beginning to sound out notes to another tune. In these recordings, songs come and go amongst a host of other sounds and events. There are no exact beginnings or endings to either the fiddle tunes or to the environment in which they are played. They are blurred together. The conversation becomes musical, and the music conversational. These fieldings represent a fraction of the collections housed in the Berea College Appalachian Sound Archives in Kentucky. One of the strengths of the Berea Archives is the variety of its collections and styles of music, which span over 80 years. Several of the nearly 30 collections refer back to the person who sought out and recorded musicians across Appalachia, such as John Herod, Leonard Roberts, Bruce Green, and Kunkel. Other collections focus on self-made recordings and documentation of professional or amateur musicians, such as Nora Carpenter or Asa Martin. Still others focus on radio, public events, or festivals. Within these collections, different genres are represented: ballads and banjo music, fiddle tunes and folk tales, radio gospel programs, and lined out hymns. Most importantly, the documentation of these distinct and personal narratives create an archive assembled in a way that can be referred to as from below, rather than from a singular authoritative source. The result is an intricate collection of individual voices, each with a story to tell. These stories begin with the performers, yet are ever expanding to include the collectors, archivists, historians, as well as listeners hearing these accounts for the first time. The variety and depth of the Berea archives present a challenge to those who wish to access it. Listening to and interpreting the archives becomes overwhelming, and it is increasingly difficult to navigate its contents with acknowledgement and respect for many of its contexts that it contains. This paper considers archival interpretation and offers close and repeated listening of archival recordings as a primary method to engage with them. As each recording unfolds, I listen carefully and in solidarity with the voices of those recorded. I also listen with a composer's ear, reflective of my own background and training. Finally, I listen with what Viet Ehrlman describes as an ethnographic ear. Applied to a sound archive, listening ethnographically seeks out the social and historical contexts, as well as the sonic information and noise of the recording medium. These contexts are revealed through the sounds taking place before, during, and after the tunes, sounds that otherwise would be cut out in a commercial recording. Listening with a composer's ear and an ethnographic ear allows for a form of archival ethnography. This includes both analysis of the archival materials, as well as my personal, subjective experiences of accessing them. While archival research can be an important part of an ethnographic study, it is often used in a supportive, secondary role to complement fieldwork. Here, I reverse the process. Beginning with and rooting my research inside the sound archive, I allow it to provide suggestions and connections that lead out well beyond the confinement of its walls. This process expands and elaborates on the context present in the archival recordings. They become conflated and bleed through into one another. Listening closely to archival recordings is a sonic parallel to Kathleen Stewart's suggestion to pay attention to ordinary affects. She understands these everyday moments as a tangle of potential connections, and her ethnographic observations serve as a means of threading them together. Shannon Jackson notes that the archival experience is divided between the immediacy of the working environment with its impact on the mind and body of the listener, and the ever-present distance between the listener or researcher and her subjects. The temporal and physical space between listener and archival materials are paradoxically fused and always just out of grasp. However, it is through the listening process that the past is once again present and embodied in the listener. Together, these ordinary affects of everyday life and this sudden embodiment of the past become defining elements of listening to archival recordings. They can be heard in the earnest amateur radio broadcasts of the Pritchard Quartet in 1958. The recordings begin with a young girl rattling off long lists of names, presumably of listeners to the program. I imagine each family has called in to make a request to be heard, to sit at home and listen to their own names sent back to them through the radio. As the young girl continues to read, the piano warms up, playing an arpeggiated chord. It is slightly out of tune. Someone clears their throat. A telephone rings in the background.
We'd like to sing our next number for Mr. and Mrs. Kedger Warfield and family of Rockhold Route 2, Mr. and Mrs. Ed Powers and family of Corbin, Mr. and Mrs. John R. Parton and granddaughter Gina Mackey Band, Mr. and Mrs. Jeff Carnes and Brian Storr, and for Mr. and Mrs. Tom Lee and family of King, and for Mr. and Mrs. Reed Hampton and family of Artemis. Our next number will be He's Knocking.
Here, the radio program acts as a bridge between the radio station and the listeners, between amateur and professional, between the time of the recording and the process of my listening to it a half century later. Often the recordings reveal humanity and vitality, regardless of polish or musical technique. Even though the recordings of Hiram Stamper, late in his life, no longer display the technical ability that he once had when he was younger, they are no less musical. To hear the rich open notes of Stamper's fiddle or the strong rhythms of his pounding foot is to know that he was present and active in the music, and any distinctions between right or wrong notes fall away. The recording is both a reflection and a celebration, mistakes and triumphs together, of a person and who he was at that time in his life. Sometimes I hear a performer struggling to remember a tune or lyrics only to have them almost surprisingly spill out, as Walter McNew reveals in his rendering of The Girl I Left Behind Me. The recording begins with a solo violin. The tempo is languid and slow. After McNew's nuanced performance, he begins to try to remember the lyrics.
That's an old, let's see, I knew some of the words on it. I quit my work one evening, walked down to the public square. The mayor was just arriving, I met the driver there. He handed me a letter that I might understand that the girl I left behind me had gone with another man. That's all I know of that. For I have money aplenty to serve both you and I. And right there, see, is where I can't remember to save my life what them words are, but anyway, to serve both you and I. And then he goes, and we'll ramble round from town to town with the girl I left behind. You know, it comes out of it pretty good.
Yeah.
But now that's old timey.
In this recording, I listen to and witness memory and music colliding. McNew struggles to remember the lyrics, and then, as he relaxes, they come out. Or, perhaps it is McNew's modesty revealing itself in the recording, a characteristic I have noticed again and again across the Berea archives. Perhaps McNew does not want to seem boastful of his knowledge, and as if he is showing off, and instead he allows the lyrics to come out slowly, organically, within the context of an artfully performed conversation. At other times, these in-between moments become an inseparable part of the fabric of the listening experience. When the Helton family finishes singing the hymn tune, I Know It Was the Blood, the music doesn't really stop. Something magical happens, and the song immediately transforms into many things at once. A man clears his throat and begins a conversation heard in the background. A young girl continues to sing her part of the hymn's melody. Jackie Helton describes the song and recites the words. The fiddle picks up again, joyfully switching to a new tune, Keys to the Kingdom. Conversations, stories, and voices come together in counterpoint and become a new piece of music, all captured spontaneously on a single recorded tape.
What was the blood? No, it was the blood. That's an old one.
But this Uncle Scott.
Now, I know it was the blood. I know it was the blood for me. I know it was the blood. One day when I was lost, he died upon the cross. I know it was the blood for me.
Yes, now that's pretty. I love to hear
that
you say
that. Do they have that in the hymn books?
I don't know. They might have. It's all.
Well, I love it.
just over the hills. Now there's a good one. Took old John Delilah.
To tarry is to remain in a place longer than intended. I linger with these recordings, and the recordings linger too. Through repeated listening, I am able to perceive greater and greater detail in the recordings, and insignificant moments become compositional. In addition, field recordings often continue to record longer than planned, accidentally and silently capturing moments where there is no intention to perform, no self-conscious dialogue. In William Talmage's field recording of Tarry With Me, O My Savior, this lingering occurs both in the hymn and in the room, opening a space of vulnerability and expression that is held for an extended period of time. Howard Chalmer leads a group of men and women in lining out the old hymn. Before beginning to sing, Chalmer is aware of the recording device, and an awkward exchange takes place.
You can
start anytime.
I mean, you can leave your quarter off now. I'll start one line and see if I've got the right key, and then I can drop back and you can turn your quarter on. I'll tell you when we're ready to start.
All right.
Sometimes
this is not a. I can.
All
is,
right.
This is just to see how it really works. It's not going to go on.
Tarry with me, oh my Savior, for the day is passing by. Evening gathering,
interestingly, Chalmer asks for the recorder to be turned off, yet begins to sing before the others finish speaking. The first sung words are inaudible, but his voice dovetails and emerges from the conversation and rises above it in volume, becoming stronger and clear as he is more comfortable. As the group comes together, I listen to their voices moving heterophonically along a single melodic line. Each voice is distinctly heard, and each makes subtle changes, turns, and inflections that serve not only as embellishments, but also marks of individuality. But there are other sounds too. Children are playing in the background, and perhaps this indicates that it is midday. A bell rings, and later a distant train whistle blows, both coinciding in pitch with the singing. The tape warbles, indicating its age and how it has changed while sitting on a shelf waiting to be listened to. All of these sounds come together to offer a glimmer of the time and place in which the recording was made, as well as the subsequent changes that have occurred to it during its lifetime. As the group completes lining out the hymn, they finish a full half step higher in pitch than when they started. Their singing without accompaniment is unmoored, and as a result, the intensity pushes everyone up in pitch, yet all remain together. It is this aural image of several individuals and everyday sounds coming together to sing in unison, but also with variation, that can be transferred to a larger understanding of the Berea archives. These archives are broadly held together through their connection to the larger Appalachian region and its cultures, but they also allow for hundreds and even thousands of distinct voices to exist alongside each other with no single dominating style, performer, or collector. They remain independent and interdependent, singular and connected, and powerfully express the history of the region as it continues to unfold in the present. The practice of archival ethnography fosters an ability to hear some of the narratives present in the Berea archives, but also to add additional narratives into the mix. In Old Time Kentucky Fiddle Tunes, Jeff Todd Titan states that fiddlers do not quite possess the tunes, but rather use and care for them as a good steward tends a fertile field. This applies not only to fiddlers, but also to all who come in contact with the archival artifacts. The movement and exchange of the recordings do not end with the listener or the collector. Rather, the recordings pass through, with the listener caring for them and adding yet another layer as they continue on, ever-changing and expanding. My experiences in the Berea archives taught me that these recordings are anything but static, removed, and disengaged. I have found the opposite. Sound archives are a nexus of temporal, media, historical, and social interactions. Listening to them allows for further discursive movement within the archive, opening new insights. Both inside and outside, an embodied space is continuing to unfold, one in which each member of the community related to it can polyphonically and heterophonically contribute to this process of setting it in motion, thus keeping it circulating and alive. Thanks.
Yes, thank you very much, Brian. We have time for one question for him, and I'm sure he'd be glad to answer anything you ask him in person later. Anybody? I think it was fascinating, very fascinating. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
We're running just a little bit late. I know we probably will bleed a little bit into... I did turn that off. I don't know why it's making noise. We're going to bleed a little bit into the lunch time. And she says, so if you don't mind staying a few minutes, but we certainly want to welcome our next speaker. And let me give that bio for you.